Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jarovich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about ghost guns, guns that can be built at home with a 3D printer. Last month, the Supreme Court upheld federal regulations on ghost guns. Here to explain the technology of 3D printing is physics and engineering professor Majib Sa'i. He works with students at the University of Scranton's 3D printing lab in its Department of Mechanical Engineering. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Sa'i.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
So for those who may not know, can you first explain what a ghost gun is?
Ghost gun, or also in the colloquial language, sometimes they call it buy-build shoot guns, are the kind of guns that are not traceable. And the reasoning behind that distinction is that parts of the gun, sometimes significant parts of the gun, is produced by the person, maybe using technologies such as 3D printing or other manufacturing technologies. In other words, there is no code or serial number for those parts that the person has made themselves.
Now, can you make the entire thing on a 3D printer or just parts of it?
Definitely only parts of it. And we see that even in some of these kits that are available or were available for sale, that the main mechanism, the main parts of the gun are provided to these people. I'm specifically talking about barrel and slide sections of the part. They definitely cannot be 3D printed. But almost every other part, yes, it can be 3D printed.
Now, in your 3D printing lab, have you printed parts for a ghost gun?
No, there is no reason for us to do that. But also, you know, I probably need to answer a lot of questions before doing such a thing.
Right. Okay. So how do gun builders get the rest of the parts? So it's in these kits. So there's certain parts they know they can build at home. You need to have a 3D printer, I guess. And then you get the rest of the kit wherever.
That's true. There are some kits that are even more complete, meaning that you don't need to even produce any of the parts using 3D printing or any other technologies. But there are kits that they provide, again, the main mechanisms to you, and you can 3D print or produce the parts using other technologies. Now, with that being said, it's important to also understand that there are also online resources that, for better or worse, are available, and some layperson with minimum amount of knowledge can even download the files and make the parts that maybe they lack in their assembly.
Now, as you mentioned, the ghost guns don't have serial numbers, meaning the government can't track them. A recent Supreme Court case decided that the ghost gun kits will now require background checks. Do you feel like 3D printed gun parts should be treated the same as regular guns?
I believe that for the people that are actually creating these parts to make a functional gun, yes, they should be treated. There should be some sort of oversight to make sure that there is some way of tracking these parts. But I don't know how doable such a policy is going to be.
Now, when you build a ghost gun with 3D printed materials, do they operate the same way as a regular gun, or is it kind of a little different to use it?
It highly depends on those parts that you are acquiring from outside resources. But if you have those parts and you have the access to the right files and the right machinery, you can produce guns that are very comparable to the guns that you buy from a gun store.
Is it expensive to build part of a gun using a 3D printer and then buying the kit for the rest?
It's actually very cheap, especially when you think about it, that 3D printing machines nowadays, you can get them as low as a couple of $100. And then the resin costs is going to be minimum. And in terms of getting the technology to work for you, You don't need any kind of advanced degree. A layperson with maybe an hour or 2 hour education can get that 3D printer to work and create the parts that produce to complete that gun mechanism.
Now, I know that the first 3D printers from years ago took a long time to print each thing. Are they faster now? How long does it take to print what you like a piece of one of these ghost guns?
It depends on the technology, frankly speaking, and the reasoning for that is 3D printing uses different technologies. They are some of them that they are based on fusion of the polymers, melting and resolidification of polymer. Some of them are laser based. Some of the laser based 3D printers they print a layer at a time versus some other ones they are printing a spot at every moment. So it depends on the technology and the 3D printer that you have. But I would say that it's definitely faster than before, especially with the ones that do printing in terms of a layer is printed at a time instead of every single point of the material is being printed at each point of time.
So the layered ones are faster. I've seen videos of them when they lay the layers down. So those are faster. Can you like can you print something in like are we talking like days or are we talking like an hour or two?
We are talking about hour or two for sure. Even for the slower versions, as long as you have the technology know-how and you can break it down instead of trying to print the entire thing at one go, you can definitely speed up the process. So even with the slower 3D printers, you can manipulate so you can have a functional gun, let's say in half a day maximum.
Okay. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we are talking about ghost guns with engineering and physics professor Majib Zaei. And so Luigi Mangione was rumored to have used a ghost gun in the shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last December. He pleaded not guilty to a federal murder charge. In our email exchange with you about this topic, you mentioned that this topic has become popular recently. Have people been asking you about ghost guns more and more ever since this happened with the UnitedHealthcare CEO?
Yes, that's definitely have been the case, and it's interesting that something needs to happen and then the questions come in.
So, yeah, have your students expressed curiosity or interest in these? Do you talk about them in class? I mean, I know you said you're not building one, and that's fine. But do they talk about them and like talk about the technology and the use of them?
Some students do, but I think that, frankly speaking, students maybe they are a little too busy with all the other things that are happening in their life. But I've got a lot more attention from media and news, and even some of the internal offices inside the university making sure that the utilization of devices is legal.
So you work with students in the University of Scranton's 3D printing lab, which is a part of the Department of Mechanical Engineering. Tell me about one of your classes. What are some types of things that your students try to build with a 3D printer?
With the 3D printing specifically, it's a scenario that you are taking advantage of the flexibility that the 3D printing machines provide to you. We need to pay attention with the 3D printing. Usually, we are not talking about a high quality product, and that means both in terms of the accuracy of the product, but also in terms of the quality, such as mechanical properties. That may be even important in a scenario like gun production scenario. The other thing that we use 3D printing specifically is that a lot of the times you can create prototypes, meaning that you have an idea, you are not completely sure how this design is going to work. You have it in the computer, you can look at the picture and animation, but you think that you benefit with having this prototype in hand and actually seeing in real life how it looks like. And that's one of the major utilizations of 3D printing at the University of Scranton. It's also complementary for some other manufacturing processes that we have at the university. So, for example, say that you want to produce a part using the casting process, casting of metals, you can create the imprint using 3D printing, and then use that pattern, that plastic pattern that has been produced using 3D printing, to then convert it to a metal part using the casting technology.
Now, my exposure to 3D printing is limited to tiny toys because one of my son's friends, their family happens to have a 3D printer, and occasionally he will bring home like a cute little plastic toy that his friend was like, "Hey, I 3D printed this," and he just like creates a, you know, it's kind of like a monster insect bug thing of his own creation, and he printed it, right? It's super, and some of them are super cute. So that's my exposure to 3D printing. Can you give me some examples of some things that are that your students have made? Like, what's something that has really wowed you?
Yes, I am specifically, I would say, impressed when I see a student uses the mechanics of 3D printing to create an assembly. And that's a machine that is consisted of many parts, and much attention has been paid into how these parts are going to sit together. So, for example, I have a students that make, sub parts of the for example, human mechanism, walking mechanism in humans. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
And so what happens is that they need to go ahead and do research about all the subsections of this assembly, and they also need to take into consideration what it takes to actually have these parts move by the side of each other, because it's a totally different ball game when you are talking about a moving product or assembly. And so I'm specifically impressed when I see students and go ahead create assemblies that are a combination of different parts, including parts that have been created through the 3D printing. Definitely that's very useful for that kind of projects.
And I'm assuming that at where you are at your university, you have a 3D printer that's pretty fancy, pretty like bigger, more expensive than these ones that people can have at home, right? So you what you're talking about in building something like that's not something that someone can do on their at-home printer.
That's true. The size of the 3D printer, specifically as you mentioned, the bigger size that we have on campus, that would help to ease the process. But frankly speaking, with some, expertise, you can always break the parts to smaller sections, figure out a way to assemble together them in a way that if you want them to stay fixed with respect to each other, they stay constant, or if you want to create mechanisms that something slides and something else maybe moves or rotates, you can create all those kind of setups. So I would say that yes, we have the advantage to make the projects easier, but if someone wants to create similar mechanisms at home, it's just a couple more steps breaking down the structures furthermore.
And we started the segment talking about ghost guns. Is there anything else off limits for your students to 3D print besides ghost guns?
Yes, I would say that's an interesting question. I would say that a lot of the times, anything that can be used as a weapon, I actually had a team of students recently wanted to make a crossbow, and we've been banned from making that one either. So a lot of the times, these kind of mechanisms that are mostly for, I don't know, hunting, they can hurt others. Those are the kind of mechanisms that we want to stay off.
And just as a final question, do you see that, maybe 10 years in the future, 20 years in the future, will everyone in their house have a 3D printer? Is this something that is just going to become something that everyone does and knows how to do? Or is it still going to be like a specialty thing where just certain people want them?
That's a very interesting question. I would say that, in my opinion, it mainly depends on the needs, because I don't think that even nowadays the price point is a blockage. I don't think that people are holding on because they are worried in terms of how to use or maintain a 3D printer. It's mostly about whether it's going to be useful to them or not. I would say that for the hobbyist, it's something that even nowadays is available and a lot of people take advantage of. But for the average person, I would say if they are bored, definitely that's going to be a nice setup to create your the toys for the
Lots of
kids.
tiny toys and action figures, right? Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. University of Scranton Physics and Engineering Professor Majib Saeed, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the first passive home in Central Ohio. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Stephen Rhodes is the owner of a home that he designed and built himself. But it isn't your average home. Stephen's home is a passive home and the first of its kind in Central Ohio. Joining us now is Stephen Rhodes, designer and builder of Central Ohio's first passive home. Welcome to Tech Tuesday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So first of all, we're going to start with, what exactly is a passive home?
What's a passive home? Okay. Yeah, that's a great question to start off with. And passive house or passive building is kind of a design and build methodology for buildings of any type. So the key goals are energy efficiency and to really reduce operational costs, but also to increase the comfort and the durability and the resilience of a building.
Now, I've heard of green building. I've heard of LEED certified. Where does the word passive come in? Is that different?
Yeah, it's a little bit different. But the things you mentioned, too, they're different types of high-performance building, usually with slightly different focuses. You know, LEED has its own method of programming where, you know, it's kind of a stepped system of the silver and the gold and platinum. You can kind of pick and choose certain strategies to make a building more sustainable, widely used in commercial spaces. But passive house is pretty much all or nothing in terms of certifying. So when you're certifying a passive house, you have certain energy and power targets that you have to meet. And a lot of review goes into the design process to make sure that that a building has minimal moisture risk and is durable, in addition to being energy efficient. And so you go through the whole program, and you have to really tick off all those boxes. And so it's a little bit of a different program for the others, but it's a high performance methodology like those others.
So what got you interested in the idea of building a passive house? I mean, you could have built any kind of house. You could have just built a random house with solar panels on top. Why did you decide to go through this process?
Well, you know, I guess it started really my interest in sustainable building in college when I took a class on renewable energy, and we had a great book that we used as a textbook that in a certain section introduced the ideas of sustainable building, and passive house came up. And, you know, I just started to learn about all the different things that make a passive house a little bit unique from, you know, a code minimum type of build, which is what we generally do around here. And I was really interested in the potential for using passive house to greatly improve houses and buildings that we build, including in Central Ohio. I mean, I felt that there was, I guess, some low-hanging fruit to be had in moving to something like passive house. And I didn't want to just build the ordinary thing that everyone else was building. Quite honestly, they can do it better than I can, you know, if it's the standard fare. But I wanted to really push myself to do something different.
To build an actual certified passive house, do you have to build it from the ground up, or can you convert an old house into a passive house?
No, you actually can convert. So there's actually an entire retrofit program within the passive building standard. So you can certainly do that, and it's highly encouraged. It's great to be able to use an old building. It comes with its own unique sets of challenges, as does building new. But yeah, there are a lot of people out there successfully retrofitting old buildings.
Are there a lot of passive houses in the U.S.? I mean, is this a ongoing, is this a new trend, or have I just never heard of it?
It is a trend,
yeah.
But it's still in its relative infancy, I think. It's been around for maybe a couple or three decades, but it's still a little bit of a niche, especially in the Midwest. You know, you see passive houses a lot more in the New England area and generally the Northeast, as well as the Pacific Northwest. And that's due to a variety of factors. Energy is more expensive there. They have more progressive energy codes and policy generally that helps facilitate some of that. But it's been around. It's just creeping in Ohio, though. Maybe a couple thousand projects, I think, certified passive house.
Who certifies them? Is there an organization?
There is an organization. So I have a personal certification as a building consultant, a design consultant with FIAS.
Yeah, tell me, what does FIAS stand for? I was looking for the acronym. Yeah,
yeah, it's an acronym that stands for Passive House Institute U.S.
Okay.
Of course, these days they really...
Just go by FIAS.
They just go by FIAS. It's like lowercase FIAS. The branding has changed a little bit, but the mission's the same. And yeah, it's Passive House Institute U.S.
Okay. Yeah. Now, you picked to build your passive house in Clintonville, a neighborhood I'm very familiar with, and you, so all the houses around you are the opposite of passive, because they're all like 100 years old, and probably not the most energy efficient things on the block. So did you have a lot of people coming up to you and asking you a ton of questions as you were building?
Yeah, I did. You know, I'm on a little bit of a busy street, and so I had some visibility, which is you know, is good and bad. But one of the good things is that I met a ton of people, including plenty of neighbors who were just asking, you know, what is that? Or someone who's maybe in the building industry who would come up and say, there's something different about this one. And yeah, so I chose to build in Clintonville in an infill lot, one of the last remaining empty lots. I didn't knock down anything to build it. And that was an extra challenge that I set for myself. I wanted to build a home, in an established area to help kind of increase the density of housing instead of, you know, promote sprawl outward.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about Central Ohio's first passive home built by our guest today, Stephen Rhodes. Do you have an engineering degree, or do you have a construction degree? Like, did you know what you were doing, or did you learn along the way?
I have a mechanical engineering degree from West Virginia University. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I have an honorary construction degree now from the house build. But no, I don't have a deep history in the construction industry. I just started really with my house. I've done a little bit of volunteering with Habitat for Humanity in various places. So I've been involved with construction at a few different phases, but to say that I was any kind of really deep expert on construction before I started my house would be an overstatement.
Okay, so the house is all electric, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, and most of that electricity is generated from solar panels, is that correct?
Right. It should be net zero on an annual basis. So we'll have to wait and see after this summer if I can catch up from over the winter. But
that was my next obvious question, as people always ask that. Is there enough sun in Central Ohio to power the whole thing?
Yeah, there should be. So I did the energy modeling on all this to get an estimate of how much energy I would consume in this house. And then paired that up with a solar array that was sized to provide that amount of energy within a year. So, plus or minus a few percent, I hope. I should, by the end of October, I should know, because that's when I fired up the solar array for the first time last year. And so there is enough sun. With 18 panels on the roof, I should have enough sun to be at net zero.
Okay. And now what kind of battery do you have?
I'm actually grid tied, so I don't have a battery at all.
Oh, well, explain that to me. Okay.
Yeah, so a grid tied solar system like I have interfaces with the electrical grid to share power back and forth. So on a really sunny day, in the middle of the day, like say yesterday, I was making all kinds of energy and it was really moderate temperatures. I wasn't using much. So I was sending my electricity back into the grid for others to use. And then, you know, of course, when it's 20 degrees out and cloudy on a January day, I'm not making much of any solar power, and then I'm pulling in from the grid. So it's a trade back and forth. So I have no battery system.
Okay. Interesting. So tell me, besides the solar panels on the roof, what else does this house have that other houses don't have that makes this a passive house?
Yeah, I mean, the solar panels are really beside the point.
Okay, yeah, so, sure.
Yeah, they're a great add-on to make it net zero energy, but the aspects of my house that make it a passive house are first, that I have a lot of insulation. So it's about double the insulation of a normal house. Mm. It's very tightly air sealed, and that prevents cold air from coming in the winter and hot air from coming in the summer, which costs a lot of energy to heat up. I have triple pane, high performance windows that really cut down on energy use. And I've also sited my house in a way that I can make use of that south sun, especially in the winter, when the sun is at a really low angle, it comes right in and penetrates through the building and warms it up. But I have roof overhangs that prevent that direct solar gain in the summer when I'd prefer not to have it. So those are the big things. And with the air tightness that I have, I also have a mechanical ventilation system, a heat recovery energy recovery ventilation system that makes sure that the air quality is at the top level at all times.
And you had help in the process. I mean, you did a lot of this on your own, from what I understand. But did you contract out some of it, or did you how did you build this? You can't build the whole thing by yourself.
No, you really can't build the whole thing by yourself. I did as much as I possibly could. But I like to say I built it myself with a lot of help. So I started with, I had an excavation contractor, narrow lot between two existing homes. You don't want to make a mistake there. But I, from the foundation work on, I was the laborer. I did my own framing. One of the things I did was I would build the walls on the floor deck and then call up a couple friends, say, hey, do you have a few minutes after work today? And they'd come over and help me raise the walls. So I had a lot of help there. I had a lot of help framing the floors and that. But I framed it. I installed the roof myself. I did all the trim work. I did the paint, the insulation. I installed the windows and doors. I had the experts do the electrical system, the plumbing, and things like that. Yeah.
Now, I have a picture of the house sitting in front of me because you were featured in Columbus Monthly magazine. But for our listeners, can you describe what it looks like? I mean, it looks like a typical house. It's not like a passive house. Doesn't look like, it's not like an igloo or anything.
No, I think once it's finished, it's not going to really stand out too much. My house is a little bit more on the I guess modern contemporary design aesthetic, but I think it fits in fairly well with the surrounding century-old Clintonville homes. It's got horizontal lap siding outside. You know, it has plenty of windows to let in light. I'm not subject to just looking out little portholes to save energy. So there's lots of natural light. It's fairly compact in its form. It's roughly cube shaped, but. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything that that really would tip you off that there's big differences under the hood, so to speak.
How many stories? How many square feet?
It's two-story with a finished basement. And with that finished basement, it comes to about 1870 square feet. So, three bedrooms, 2.5 baths.
Now, what was the most challenging part of the whole process?
Well, for me, I did the design work myself. I made all the plans. I don't have, a lot of background in doing that, so it took me more time. Mm-hmm. But being the design guy and also the general contractor and the laborer and the framer just all at once, that was a lot. Mm-hmm. I was wearing a lot of different hats at once, and you realize the value in having other people on a team when you go through that. So I would say just the big challenge was the sheer number of jobs I was trying to do at once.
Do you have a favorite part of the house?
Favorite part of the house? Yeah, I really like the stairs. It's got an open riser stair system and a wood slat wall next to it that I built. I just like the aesthetic of that. Mm-hmm. And the open first floor lets in a lot of light from the front, from the back. Yeah, I like that first floor with the slat wall.
I do like that. There's a picture of that in the magazine as well. But then also you have this just unique upper, I want to call it a upstairs patio. I don't know what to call it, right?
Or Yeah. I call it the upper deck.
Upper deck, yeah. So it's an open air deck, but it's on the second floor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I have an attached garage, but it's a little bit larger than the footprint of the second floor, so the remainder of the top of the garage I turned into a deck area, that is a lot of fun to be up there sometimes. Yesterday evening it was really nice to mm-hmm. just sit up there and relax.
Now, do you have plans? Is this your future, or do you plan on building more passive homes?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I'm actually working on one right now in Old Town East. It's a project that I'm collaborating on with Blake Compton, Compton Construction, and okay. Designer Jeremy Miller. So that's going to be the second single-family passive house in Central Ohio. If and when we get that certified, we're on good track. And, I do some other independent work on the design front and construction consulting in different areas. It ranges from Plain City to Ostrander, Grove City, Columbus. Yeah.
Do you feel like in the next, 5 to 10 years, will Central Ohio have a lot more passive houses? Are we going to continue to see this?
I do think we're going to see a lot more of this. We're a little bit behind the rest of the country in our adoption of high-performance building like this. We're blessed with low energy costs, and we're not being pushed along as much as other places with our energy codes, but they are coming. Mm. So passive house is really one of the most viable ways to meet those new energy codes and to build high-quality housing that's cost-optimized. Yeah, it's going to work really well in Central Ohio, and I expect to see more.
Does it cost more to build a passive house and then you save money on the back end?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. It does cost a little bit more up front, especially in an area here where we don't have, financial incentives to specifically pursue mm-hmm. passive house like they do in some places. But you pay a little bit more up front, and you save on operational costs. And if you consider that altogether, you really find that a building can be less expensive when you build a passive house standard over a 30-year mortgage, let's say.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you to Stephen Rhodes, designer and builder of Central Ohio's first passive home. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk with Russell Hawley about Apple moving its operations to India. That's when Tech Tuesday continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich, and this is Tech Tuesday, a show where we showcase stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Tariffs and made in China are two terms that have sparked a lot of concern. Apple is now taking action with plans to move operations to India. Joining us to talk about this and other topics is Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So Apple, what parts of Apple does the company plan to move to India?
Specifically, the part that assembles a lot of the hardware that would come here to the US. So they're going to start, they've started right away by shipping individual components for what would make an iPhone to their facilities in India so that the phones can be assembled there before they're sent here to the US.
Okay. So is this shift, I mean, were they already planning to move to India, or is this related directly to the tariffs?
A little column A, a little column B. So Apple has been working over the last 10 years to diversify its manufacturing set all over the world. It's it hasn't been explicitly in China or the US or, you know, anywhere for quite some time now. The individual components are spread out largely based on how much business the company does in that country. So China, for example, makes up about 15% of Apple's total revenue each year, which is why there's a fair bit of assembly and development that goes on in that country. India is not a country that Apple has been particularly successful in until the last couple of years, when it started making more budget-focused products specifically for that region. To compete with the other phones that are in that area. But even that is starting to ramp up in ways that Apple is taking advantage of.
Will this change any of Apple's current processes? Will it shift anything, make it slower for us to get iPhones moving around the country?
It's not immediately clear what the delay in shipping is going to be. Right now, Apple, for you know what announcements it has made, this is specifically about making sure that there are stores of phones here in the US, not just for a new phone launch at some point in the future, but, you know, existing things that people would be buying today, to, you know, store as much of that here as possible in an attempt to, you know, reduce any potential issues moving forward with tariffs.
Have you heard about other companies taking the same route, moving operations to a different country?
Not nearly to the scale, but yes, there are other companies that are looking at, you know, what it would take for there to be an assembly process here in the US, or for the assembly process to be, you know, other places where there are, you know, just fewer tariffs than you would see in China specifically, which is currently set to 145%.
Yeah. So, I mean, does the United what the Trump administration wants is they want these things being built here in the U.S. Does the U.S. have some phone manufacturing happening, or is it all overseas?
Most of what you're going to find is overseas. It's a lot of robotics facilities that are, you know, doing the assembly. So we're not, you know, it's not human beings that are doing most of the component assembly. And these, up until very recently, had been facilities that could just handle assembly of a whole bunch of different products at a much larger scale than most other places, because those facilities were built 10, 15 years ago to account for the kind of volume that exists today. Relocating any part of that process here to the US is certainly possible. It's just going to take quite a long time to build facilities like that and to staff them in a way that, you know, would allow for the same level of production would almost assuredly increase costs.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be so expensive if you already had this facility that's been making iPhones for, I don't know, what year are we on, 20 years, then I can't imagine just starting over from the ground up if you've never built one here. That would cost so much money.
That's exactly right. And it's not immediately clear, you know, this would be, like a huge job opportunity to bring people in, because these are largely robotics facilities. The total number of humans that staff these on any given day is actually quite low compared to something you would see like in an auto manufacturing plant or something like that.
Yeah. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. I wanted to move on to a new Chromebook, the Acer Chromebook Plus 516 GE. That name is a mouthful. Did I even get it correct?
You definitely got it correct. And yes, for some reason, most laptops just never caught on to the like iPhone naming scheme. They've almost all got these kind of crazy multi-character names that are very difficult to remember.
Yeah. Why? Okay, I have so many questions. I know GE stands for Gaming Edition. I learned that. So I got that part.
That is right.
What's the 516, 516?
That is the 500 series is what Acer calls its Chromebook line. And so different numbers get attached to that series in a way to, you know, kind of highlight, you know, in this case, 16 refers to how large the screen is, because this is a 16-inch laptop.
Okay, fun. Well, anyway, the name is a lot. What are some features of this new Chromebook?
So typically when you find Chromebooks in a Best Buy or, Walmart or on Amazon, the screen size is often quite small. 12 to 14 inches is pretty standard for what you would see with most Chromebooks, especially ones that are available in classrooms, which is where a vast majority of Chromebooks are seen on a day-to-day basis. So this being a larger screen that has some additional hardware that is focused on the ability to not just play games, but also do some very light 3D, editing and modeling and stuff like that, is kind of unique amongst its competitive set. But it's also able to do that for under $500.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think I read in the article you had reviewing this that it is actually more affordable than a smaller one because it's like on sale right now or something. Is that right?
Yes, so this is new, but it is something that is available at a discount almost entirely because Acer is aware that this time of year, there are folks that are either moving on from middle school to high school or moving from high school to college, and Chromebooks are the machines that they have known their entire educational career at this point. So by the time they are moving on to a point where it is time to kind of have their own, offering an option with a larger screen that allows them to do more than just, take notes and go on websites, is very important. And Acer has been one of the companies that have kind of dominated in that space for the last couple of years, where students are kind of graduating from a shared computer to to their own machine. This ends up being a very affordable option.
Now, what happens mostly with Chromebooks is they don't last very long or they run out of storage too quickly. How does this one compare?
Like a lot of the, more modern Chromebooks, they have the ability to expand the storage if storage is an issue. One minor complaint that we had with this particular laptop is that it's using the less expensive and not nearly as performative USB port. So if you want to connect like a great big hard drive to it by use of a cable instead of using like a memory card or installing actual storage inside the laptop, the speed's not going to be great as far as moving big files from one place to another. But you can eliminate that pretty easily with kind of different ways of having storage available on your machine.
So you mentioned, that Acer's trying to get people to buy this when they want to upgrade a laptop. Would you recommend this for students? Is this a good starter laptop for a new college student?
I think this is a great starter laptop for new students, especially if, the Google's Chrome OS experience is what you're used to, because that ends up being kind of the most important thing when you go from kind of a shared laptop to something that is yours, is that it be something that you're familiar with and that you actually know how to use. The same goes for schools that largely focus on delivering iPads. They tend to grow to have a MacBook as their kind of starter machine when they go to another thing. The difference in price between a MacBook and this machine is almost $2,000 in some cases. But yeah, this provides everything that you would need to competently perform any schoolwork activity in high school and most college situations.
That's interesting because I hadn't really ever thought about it, but I guess it's you're used to what you're used to because I whenever my my son has a Chromebook at school, obviously, and whenever he has to just like he wanted to show me an assignment and he had to do it on my computer and he struggled with the trackpad because I guess you're just used to what you use at school, right? And so once you get used to it, that's is it tend to be the once you get used to something, you stick with that company.
Yes, I mean that was true of Windows machines in the 90s and early 2000s, and it's very much the same now with Chromebooks for a pretty significant majority of schools here in the US.
And I mentioned the GE in this long name for this Chromebook stands for Gaming Edition. So is this a good gaming laptop? I mean, you love gaming. Would you use this Chromebook for that?
It's kind of a mixed statement. So no, I would not
No.
say that the way that when most people envision the term gaming laptop, it is a video game that you have installed on the computer that runs locally on the computer and has a certain kind of graphical experience that is associated with that. In this context, this is very much what I would call a game streaming laptop, which would mean that you would pay through other services, be it Xbox Game Pass or NVIDIA's cloud gaming service. And having the larger screen and the graphics system inside of this is good enough that you would be able to have a really enjoyable experience that way, but not in the way that I think most folks envision a quote-unquote gaming laptop, which is like a really powerful machine that runs everything locally. You would still very much need an internet connection in order to game on this in the way that most people would consider.
This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Russell Hawley. Another topic we have for today is if you want to lose weight and build muscle fast, according to the newest fitness trend, all you need to do is stand on a vibration plate. This is an exercise machine. Yes, you're chuckling. I'm chuckling too. An exercise machine that shakes rapidly when you stand on it. Tell me about this new trend, the vibration plate.
So the design is relatively simple. There is a rectangular plate that is on the ground that you stand on, and it has a whole bunch of motors in it that can, you know, kind of vibrate very, very quickly. And it, you know, shakes your whole body in a way that if the people who are listening are immediately reminded of the like vibration belt machines that existed, 30 years ago.
80s, 90s. Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So this if it feels similar, that's because it is. There's a lot of, you know, kind of similar concepts here where you're able to kind of, we've got some more modern technology here. So vibration plates have some directional functionality as far as the, you know, where the vibrations are happening and how frequently they're happening. But there are, it turns out, tangible health benefits to doing this. Not nearly as many as you would see claimed online, where, you know, your life has been radically changed because you stand on this thing for 20 minutes a day. But it turns out that there are some actual benefits to muscle tone and circulation, and in some cases, bone density.
Now, are those benefits independently verified, or does the company just say so?
This is not something that we have relied on a company. Our CNS wellness team has actually worked with health experts in the field to kind of dispel some of the, you know, this is not a weight loss quick thing, which is what you would see a lot of these companies online claiming, that, you know, standing on this for a certain period of time would accomplish that. But if you decide to participate in this, there are some actual health benefits that studies have actually borne out as fact.
Now, how does the vibration part work in this? So you like how if you so you stand on it, and how is the machine able to sustain weight and also vibrate so rapidly?
So there are, in many cases, upwards of 8 different motors that are inside of this that are all attached to, you know, kind of gear platforms that are designed to move you back and forth. And whether or not the plate that you're using can sustain your specific weight will depend very much on the quality of the one that you buy. Mm-hmm. There are some that are limited to, you know, anywhere from 180 to 220 pounds, but there are a couple of the more expensive ones that go up as high as 500 pounds.
Okay. And so has vibration technology evolved over time? I mean, is this using different ways of making the vibration than those belts we talked about from the 80s?
Absolutely. We've got smaller, more powerful motors that can do infinitely more than some of those giant things that you would see pictures of in the 80s be capable of, and considerably less expensive as well.
Okay. So there's different... I was looking at your article. There's different exercises you do on the plate. So you're not necessarily just standing still on it. You can do push-ups and planks and tricep dips, but you also can just stand still. Is that right?
Yeah. So there is an option to just stand still, but there are quite a few exercises that include, you know, just kind of basic squats and things like that. And the argument behind that is the increased circulation. So, you know, you're able to, By having this vibration happen while you're doing things like squats, you're able to circulate things like lactic acid much faster, which are the things that make your muscles sore after you have done, you know, a workout or a massage or something like that. The buildup of lactic acid is a great deal lessened because it's able to circulate through your body a little easier.
Are there safety concerns with this technology? Not just falling off of it, I guess, but also there's certain people with certain conditions who shouldn't use it.
That's right. There are a few medical professionals who have noted that if you have existing conditions, hip pain, knee pain, things like that, that there's a risk that this will agitate that further. And there are a few cases of things like temporary dizziness and joint stress that have come from folks who either already have specific ligament conditions. So definitely make sure that you're talking to an actual doctor and not an internet doctor before trying one of these.
So do you see more health tech innovations coming like this in the future? I mean, is this are we going to have more vibration plates and are we just going to shake our fat off of us?
I don't see that this is going to be something that we're going to have in every home the same way that you would have like an exercise bike or a treadmill or something like that. But it would not surprise me to see more of these show up in communal gym spaces, especially if they're able to build, kind of custom setups that are larger platforms for multiple people. I can see that being something that we would see here in the not too distant future. But no, I think that very much like the belt-driven systems of the past, that this is likely a relatively temporary fad, and its total audience is probably not going to be the biggest in a year. But it is interesting to know that there are some genuine health benefits to it.
Yeah, I think I would want to try it out first before I would invest in it. So I would need to find a
gym. I would be interested in trying it. I don't know that I want to be in front of other people when I do it.
Yes. Okay. So try in private. That's a good point. All right. Well, thank you, Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks for joining us, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this is All Sides and Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News.